Professor Keith Alexander is a New Zealand engineer who invented what's been called the world's safest trampoline. And 500,000 have been sold around the world now. It's called the Spring Free Trampoline. And it's now assembled in a Spring Free factory in China, though the secret sauce elements are still made in New Zealand. Professor Alexander is based at the University of Canterbury. One of his projects is improving open ocean shellfish farming. I asked him how much he is still involved with the trampoline.
I'm part-time. I'm 0.2 of my time there, but it doesn't really end up being 0.2 of my time. It's a week every now and then, or some special project, strategy meeting, something like that, or they want to change some significant part, and I've got the history. Those are the sorts of things.
Because you became the face of Spring Free Trampoline, didn't you, after Costco got it off the ground around the world and then they stopped stocking it, you kind of became the face of the product, the Dyson of the trampoline.
That's exactly what I was asked. Would you like to become the Dyson of Spring Free? And I didn't even know what he meant. But yes, and I thought, well, if it's going to help them sell, that's fine. Let's do that. It was actually quite terrifying, the whole process of being videoed for a week.
And would you have preferred to stay in the back room?
That's where I'm more comfortable, yes.
So do you go to China as well, where it's assembled?
Yes. I was up there at the strategy meeting in May.
And how's that?
Well, it's interesting. There's 200 or so people up there.
Employed by Spring Free?
Yes, the Spring Free factory up there. And they had a little celebration because that factory had just produced its 300,000th trampoline while I was there. There was another factory before. That's how come we get to 500,000 now. But so they were having a celebration, and I was asked to say something. But, of course, they can't understand it, so it had to be all translated. So I really just said, thank you for all your hard work. And then I thought afterwards, I wish I'd known. I might have said something more significant. It's a strange feeling that all those people are working on a product that I invented, and I really don't know them and feel out of touch with them, except when it comes to the details of the design.
It must seem very strange. When you first invented the trampoline, and it was no easy thing. You had to have this prototype and that prototype, and finally you got the trampoline pod, as it were. It's like a trampoline pod. Did you ever think that it would become known around the world as the world's safest trampoline?
I'm a technical backroom person, as you've pointed out, and my vision for it was maybe I would sell something like 10% of the trampolines that are sold in New Zealand. I was working at the time with a company in Levin, Canvasland in Levin, and they sold 400 trampolines a year. And I was thinking, if they could have 10% of my trampolines sold alongside theirs, that would be amazing. So that was about my vision. I was really thinking pretty small.
And the story of you becoming in touch with Steve Holmes, the Canadian investor entrepreneur, that seems, in retrospect, kind of inevitable. But how did that happen?
Well, that happened in a pretty systematic way. The university had Canterprise, that was the commercial arm, and anything that was invented that could be commercial at the university, by default, belongs to the university. And the commercial arm, which was Canterprise, tries to get investors to take it to the market.
But this is the university that has said no to you a few times and said, nah, not interested really.
Yes, indeed, it was the university that said that. They were interested in things that were going to turn over millions of dollars. They weren't really interested in a child's toy. But to be fair on them, they got it to market. It was that process that got it to where it is today. And I was very fortunate to be involved in the process and go along with it and see how it all worked, because as a technical person, I knew how to do the engineering, but as for taking something to market, I knew very little about that, and I just had to trust them to get the right people to do it.
How much of your time are you devoting to the trampoline at that point?
At that point, it was probably something like 20%, 10% to 20% of my time as engineering academics, we're allowed to have about one day a week doing consultancy work, so we're keeping in touch with the real world. And at the time I was developing the trampoline, I was putting a lot of my consultancy time into working on developing prototypes and improving the product.
And when you met Steve Holmes, did you think, yes, this is the man?
Oh, I was quite frightened of him because he's an alpha male. He's a born leader. Comes across as a very powerful person. And when I met him, I knew he was coming, and that was made me apprehensive in itself. And he turned up with his lawyer, and so there were two of them, all with Canadian accents. It was pretty scary. Did I think he was the man? I wasn't thinking that. I was just hoping that he was the man, and how it was going to go, I really couldn't judge at the time.
Did you have a lawyer?
No, not then. I didn't have a lawyer then. I got advised to get a lawyer pretty quickly after that. The reason was the American legal system has got a very long arm, and what they wanted to do was get me into a position where if something happened to somebody in America and there was a case, then I wouldn't lose my house. I'd lose a small company instead. So I wasn't seeing a lawyer then, but I did soon afterwards, yes.
And at what point did you think, yeah, this is going to work, this marriage of money and know-how is really going to work?
Well, I can't describe that point. It was just a lot of slog, a lot of to and froing and going this way and that and making decisions. And the point that I really remember was when I got sent a photograph of Costco, Quebec, and in that photograph there was our trampoline hanging up in what looked like the inside of the warehouse in New Zealand, just a huge store, and the trampoline was hanging up there, so you couldn't avoid it. And it suddenly hit me that maybe we've made it. Here it is on the other side of the world in a big store on display, and it seems to be keeping on going. It seems to be working.
And Costco is the big one. I mean, Costco, if you got into Costco, the future seemed rosy, correct?
Costco's one of the big ones. There's Walmart, as everyone would say, is the big one, but it's the very cheap one. And then there's Sam's Club that is a bit smaller, but it's the higher end. And Costco's got a different character. It's rather more customer-focused in that it has promises that it makes to the customers, and it chooses what it thinks customers will be done best by.
The story about Costco is that they'd always refused to stock trampolines because trampolines had a reputation of being dangerous. And then they were persuaded to stock the Spring Free trampoline. But the CEO visited some store in Nova Scotia that had, you know, the trampoline on display, and when they're making a big deal out of it, and he said, "What? That's a trampoline. Get it out of here." And suddenly you didn't have Costco anymore. That seems such a bizarre story.
It's a bizarre story. It was out of my hands. It was Steve Holmes's decision to try and get it into one of the big box stores. I was very impressed when he would ring me up and say, "This is what I've been doing. I've been playing golf with the CEO of Walmart, and he says our trampoline's going to be too expensive, so we can't sell it through Walmart."
And it was kind of high-end, right?
It is high-end, yes. It is high-end.
Still is.
It still is, and that allows it to have enough of a margin that we can make it so that it's going to last and make it strong enough so it'll be there for a long time and safe.
So Walmart, it was too out of its price range.
Yes. Costco, Steve formed a relationship with Costco. He found out pretty soon that Costco US was not going to sell trampolines, but he had Costco Canada, where he lived in Toronto. And he formed a close relationship with those people, and in quite a short time, he was one of their best suppliers. And they sold lots of them, and the numbers grew rapidly in Canada. And his view was, all I've got to do is convince Canada, Costco Canada, and then Costco America will come on board. And then we've got all of the North America. So that was his focus. That was his strategy. And when the CEO of Costco said, get it out of here, we're not going to sell trampolines. He lost his whole market because he had invested in one customer.
How did he break the news to you?
I don't really remember. I think he was very busy damage control, figuring out what he could do next. It wasn't so much of an issue for us back down here in New Zealand because it was selling pretty well in New Zealand. It was selling pretty well in Australia. And what happened in Costco Canada didn't really affect us all that much until we thought about it.
And he saw his investment going down the plug hole, presumably?
All the effort that he'd put into developing that market, yes, that went down the plug hole. He had to think of other ways of selling it into North America.
And this happened just after the Chinese factory had been built to assemble the trampoline.
Yes, that's right. They initially started at a factory that was owned by an American in Xiamen, which is sort of across the border, across the water from Taiwan. And I went there a number of times and initially setting it up.
How did you feel about it being manufactured, or assembled, I should say, in China?
I had mixed feelings. I didn't know about China. China, when I was young, was a very scary place. That was where Mao Zedong came from or lived, and the Yellow Peril. We grew up with the Yellow Peril idea. So it was always pretty scary to go to China and to get on the aeroplane called Dragon Air. You kind of thought, am I actually going to get there or not? But the economic zone had been opened there, and once I'd been there a couple of times, I realised things were under control in a chaotic sort of a way. And it seemed to be working. And the fact that there was no kind of slave labour that we'd been warned about, that the people seemed to be looked after pretty well and seemed to be very pleased to get a job and to be working, helped me quite a bit. It wasn't the China that we'd been warned about. It was actually a China that was making progress somewhere.
Who had the patent on your trampoline?
Well, the original patent that I got was an American patent, and I owned it. And then the university required me to assign it to them. That was only one patent. And when Steve Holmes bought it from the university, he was most indignant that there was only one patent. I can only protect it in America. What happens in Canada? What happens in Australia? What happens to the rest of the world?
Well, he was suggesting that you have to file a patent in every country that you want to be present in.
Yes, absolutely. He had that was another strategy that he had that I was very impressed with. As soon as he owned it, he wanted a whole lot of changes, and any improvements were to be patented. So he ended up with something like 13 patents in 7 different countries, which is a patent wall. It's much better than just one patent.
And so there's no chance of you being copied?
People will copy, yes. People have tried to copy. There's a lot of chance of that happening. And
see, I understood that if you filed a patent, that kind of made it public, your process, and the patent carried the risk of copying more than not having a patent.
That's right. Protecting your idea, patents is one way. There are other ways. Another way is a trade secret, where you just keep something secret. And in many ways, that's better because no one else knows. And if you go to your grave with that secret, then the world loses that. And the philosophy behind a patent is that you do explain what it is, and then you've got a monopoly for 20 years. So those two of them, the patent and then the trade secret, give you some protection. And Springfree has both of those.
How's it got a trade secret if it's being assembled in China? Can't everybody, look at it and do it?
Yes, and they do look at it and try and do it. We were working with a New Zealand company, Pultron, who make the fiberglass rods that's actually the resilient or the spring elements in those trampolines. And they had been developing their pultrusions to act as springs for another project. But because they had done that, their product is particularly good at being a spring, and it will last a long time through many cycles. And how they do that is a trade secret. So we don't know, we don't have the recipe, and they're keeping it to themselves.
And this is made where?
This is made in Gisborne.
And always will be, because they're the only people who know how to do it.
Yes, that's
couldn't some ruthless entrepreneur reverse engineer, you know, get a trampoline, reverse engineer it and figure out how it's done?
Well, I suppose that they could, but don't suggest it to them. Just let's keep it a secret.
It might have occurred to them already, don't you think?
It might have, but it's a little bit like trying to reverse engineer somebody who's making prize-winning scones. How do you work out how much egg and how much butter and how much sugar there was in there when it's all been cooked up together? Because the making of those rods is a cooking process. They put it all together, and the fiberglass is all held together by this plastic goo that's got a lot of pieces in it, and you don't know what they are.
And you don't even know what they are?
No, I don't.
So there's no point in then kidnapping you and subjecting you to torture, because you wouldn't be able to tell them.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I wouldn't be able to tell them.
No. So when Costco said, "Nah, not having these trampolines anymore," Steve was obviously on a mission to try to replace that market, because otherwise you were sunk.
Yes, it's taken him years, and he's tried a number of different avenues. He's tried distributor networks in the US. The US is a big country, and that worked a bit. He's tried selling online, and that's worked a bit. He's also set up his own stores, so there are a number of spring-free stores in America now.
Exclusive. Selling springs.
That's right, only selling spring-free, and that's worked a bit. So all of those things he's tried, and they're all working a bit. The big issue at the moment is people are buying increasingly online, and so that's a different avenue that they're looking at.
You mean you can buy the spring-free trampoline online?
Yes, that's right.
Which makes sense.
It makes sense in some ways, but one of the things they found with this product, and they captured it in the phrase, "see us, know us," is people really need to experience it to get the idea. And people think a trampoline is a trampoline, and I don't blame them. It's got the same name, and you go and jump on it. And they don't appreciate that this one has got features that are a bit different. That is, for example, you can bounce off the net. The net is springy like the trampoline. It's like a rubber room, and all the hard pieces are out of the way. You don't have to have safety pads that might fall off covering the frame, because the frame's not there, it's somewhere else. So people think it's a trampoline, then they get on it, and then they appreciate, I can't hurt myself on anything here. It's all flexible.
You're sticking with the claim that it's the world's safest trampoline. No challenges to that title?
I would never say that as an academic. I mean, as a researcher,
hyperbole to Steve, do you?
Yes. That was their tagline. One of the most interesting experiences I had in the last few years in helping them, in my point two of my time with them.
That's such an engineering thing to say, point two of your time, isn't it?
It is an engineering thing to say.
Anyway, carry on.
Yes, is that we were challenged on that phrase with what's equivalent to the Advertising Commission, but in North America. Basically, a competitor thought, right, we'll challenge them on this. They can't say that. They can't say it's the world's safest trampoline. And it fell to me to try and give all the arguments as to why we do say it. I'm the person who wouldn't say it, but I'm the one who had to defend the arguments or give them the arguments as to why we do say that. And that was quite an interesting exercise. And there were very good reasons why we did say that. That is because it's been designed from the ground up to be safe. It's meant to last, and the safety features of it are meant to last the lifetime of the trampoline.
And did you have data and statistics to back it up?
Indeed, we did. I'd done research papers in the US looking at how ineffective pads and nets had been once they were put on trampolines, and that's largely because they seem to deteriorate with the ultraviolet light and fall off, so that then you end up with a lot of trampolines around with no pads or nets on them. Whereas our one did have that. And we did a paper in Australia because it had access to the customer database there, and asked our customers, what sort of injuries have you had? Let's have a look at them. And really we were able to show that we got rid of most of the injuries that were caused by the trampoline itself. That is, in my research, I looked at it and said, if someone's fallen on the ground, then the net wasn't working. If they've hit their face on the bar or and broken their teeth, then the pads weren't working. So I could get some sort of an idea of where the injuries came from. And I asked the same questions that we'd addressed for traditional trampolines, asked the same questions of our Australian customers. So what injuries have you had? And all the injuries were banging into each other or spraining an ankle. So the injuries came from the people themselves. And there was one exception, and there was a small percentage of people who fell off, and that was a bit of a puzzle because our net is an integral part of it. And what it turned out is when I looked at the data specifically, it's because they hadn't done up the zip. So the zip door hadn't been done up, and the kid had fallen out of the door and fallen on the ground. So we argued quite a bit about whether that was a design feature that we should change so that people have no zip to do up. They just automatically get in there and that's still.
How would you get in if there was no zip?
Exactly, yes. You have to think of some way that the door will automatically be closed when you get in.
Did you become irritable?
Did I become irritable?
Yeah. I mean, you know, for God's sake, if you don't do the zip up, then it's your problem. You can't cater for every single exigency, can you?
That's right, you can't, but you try to. As an NG, you try to. Right. I didn't become irritable, but the Spring Free people became irritable because I was saying, well, your trampoline's not as perfect as you think because people fall out the door. I was wearing two hats. I was wearing an academic hat. This is what the research says. And I was wearing my Spring Free hat, and I was hoping we'd designed the world's safest trampoline, but here's something that's not absolutely perfect.
But in the end, your arguments won the day.
No.
Oh.
In the end, arguments didn't win the day, and the Advertising Commission in the US said, no, you can't say this anymore.
So when I say it's been called the world's safest trampoline, I'm quite correct because somebody has called it the world's safest trampoline, but in fact the US authorities say it's not.
Yes, the US Advertising Commission says you can't say that. Now, it's arguable. When somebody says this is the world's safest trampoline, do you really believe that the people who made it have tested every other trampoline in the world as well as theirs, and they can prove it with that sort of data? Because that's the sort of data that the Advertising Commission said you have to have before you can say that.
Fair enough.
But I don't think anyone believes that. I think they understand that when someone says this is the world's safest trampoline, they've probably got some reason or two for saying that. And Spring Free really have, because they've got the research to back it up.
I'm talking to Professor Keith Alexander, who is an engineer and an inventor. You've been involved in a lot of design process. You worked on the design of the amphibious car that Alan Gibbs had, did you not?
Yes, that's right. That was a great experience. I was working from university Canterbury. He came to me there because I had worked at Hamilton Jet. He was trying to get people to help him design the jet for his car. But most of the people he talked to were already in the market selling water jets, and they didn't want to give away their secrets. But because I'd worked there and knew about it, he came to me. And then after I'd worked for him in a consultancy basis for a while, he said, why don't you come and work for me in UK? And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I've got a family in New Zealand. He said, right, we'll come for a month then. So we had an arrangement where once the term finished at university, I went over to UK and worked for him 6 weeks, actually. And in the process, I had the kids come over as well once school finished, and that was their trip to Europe while they were young. And it worked out really well because it turned out cost neutral. All that we earned over there, we spent on having a little tour around Europe, and then we all flew home again and went back to work. But it was great experience working on that car because that was a secret project. It was water jets that I understood, and it was very different. I had one of my most vivid experiences in the middle of winter, not the middle of winter, but pretty close to the middle of winter, on a pond in UK in the dark, because we'd worked all day and it hadn't broken, and so we had one more test to do. I'm sitting in the car looking at the rev counter, and right beside me the water's going past the door, and I can't see where we're going, but the driver knows where we're going because he's driven around this course so many times in the daytime. He can almost do it in his sleep. And the light's pointing up into the air somewhere.
So what's happened with that amphibious vehicle?
That amphibious vehicle, I think Alan still has it. He has a full range of amphibious vehicles.
Full range of vehicles.
Yes, he has.
Tanks,
Yeah, and amphibious vehicles. He's got Gibbs Amphibians in Auckland and Mount Wellington. He's got a bike and a quad ski. He's got a number of them that he's developed based on the original patent that he got from Terry Roycroft.
There's another alpha male.
Yes, very much so, yes.
Interesting, isn't it? How do you end up working with all these alpha males?
Well, they rather intrigue me. I'm not one of those, and I don't know what makes them tick. I really like to try and figure it out, and to be honest, I haven't figured it out yet.
Really? You don't think that it's, you know, the thrill of the chase and the risky, edgy chance of everything going tits up?
There's quite a lot of that. There's quite a lot of that. Yes, it's the bravado. I've tried to teach the course, a product innovation course, and pointed out all the different types of skills that need to be there. And you have one of them is the entrepreneur, whose motivation it's really the game. It's really, I've just earned $2 million this week, or I've just lost $2 million this week, and it's the bravado of being, well, just playing the big numbers.
How do you teach bravado?
I wasn't teaching it. I was really showing the students that you have these different sorts of characters, these different sorts of people. If you want to take a product to market, you need skills in a number of different areas, and it's like you're getting married to people with these hugely different characteristics, and you have to stay married long enough to get your product to market, and then you can get divorced if you want to.
Have you ever thought of being divorced from Steve Holmes?
I think it's the other way around. I hoped I wouldn't get divorced from him.
You hoped he wouldn't ask for a divorce.
That's right.
But he can't, can he? I mean, haven't you got intellectual property that he can't just, or does he own you now?
No, he doesn't own me. He does own the intellectual property, but he can't fire the inventor. I'm the inventor, and if he wants to use me in his media, then he better be nice to me.
Oh.
But he's not in it to be nice to me. He's an investor, an entrepreneur, and he's got other interests, and he could at any time say, right, I'm selling out this company because we could put our money to better use somewhere else.
And you would have no say in it. He could sell the company to somebody completely different and you would have no say in that.
That could be right. I think he would give me say in it. He's a kind man. He's a very generous man in his own alpha male sort of way.
Yeah. Does he describe himself as an alpha male?
No, I don't think he describes himself as an alpha male. No, he doesn't see himself like that.
No. But you are used in the promotion of the trampoline, and you are clearly quite useful in your non-alpha male way of persuading people that this is a good product.
Well, apparently, yes. That's what they say.
I don't know, I'm thinking of those Park and Clark advertisements that we have on television. They're so underwhelming that they are effective. Is that your tactic?
Not really. I think I'm just being myself. And they say that I come across very genuine and convincing. And I think, well, I don't know how to do that.
Years of practice. Years of practice. Yes.
I don't know what I'm doing, but if that's what they say and it's useful to them in their sales and advertising, then I think it's a good thing. I want this product to do well and be out there and ensure that children are not getting hurt when they don't need to. And so it's just part of working with them, I guess.
How many of your Spring-free trampolines are sold in New Zealand relative to other trampolines that are sold in New Zealand. Do you know that?
No, I don't know that. I don't know that. But in general terms, I'd expect a high-end product to potentially get about 10% of the market. But I don't really know what the market is in New Zealand. Right back at the start, it used to be about 20,000 units a year, but I don't know what it is. I'm not a salesperson, and I'm not keeping up with those things. That's, no. That's what the commercial people do.
There are various cheaper trampolines around, and presumably cheap imports as well. Are there standards that trampolines need to meet, safety standards?
Yes, there are safety standards, and I'm on the standards committee in the US, and I've been involved in the standards committee in Australia as well.
Isn't that a conflict of interest?
It is a conflict of interest.
Yes.
There's several conflicts of interest there. My main conflict of interest is that I was developing a trampoline, a safer trampoline, so that there was children wouldn't get injured and the parents would have a choice. But as part of that process, I invented something that was going to meet those objectives. And then that was bought by Steve Holmes. And then as part of that process, I ended up on the American Standards Committee. And being on that committee, I'm helping people set the rules to make all trampolines safe, which is a conflict with what the company trying to sell the spring-free trampolines is doing. They say, we'd much rather that our competitors were unsafe. Then we'd get a better chance at distinguishing ourselves in the market. But you're helping everybody to be safe, so that's taking away our point of difference.
Oh, how interesting. I assumed that the conflict of interest would be that you were giving spring-free trampoline an edge in the market by your presence, but it's the opposite, your colleagues are saying.
Yes, it's partly the opposite. But the other thing that's interesting about the standards is that they're done by people who are interested, of course, in that area. So they all have conflicts of interest. So the standards committee is made up in large part by manufacturers of trampolines, and they're all rubbing shoulders and wrestling with each other. And unfortunately, that tends to lead to the lowest common denominator. Let's come up with standards that don't make it hard for any of us, and let's sort of work together to milk the market almost. And they're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to go to that place. But it's really a whole process of dealing with conflicts of interest and trying to reach consensus on what's the best way forward.
And that's in the US?
That's in the US, yes.
What about here?
What about here? Well, we have a standard in Australia, and we did have one in New Zealand, which was just an older version of the one in the US. But we should have the Australian standard here. We haven't gone through the process of getting it here yet, but consumer has actually been using it anyway. And 6 years ago and just the year before last, consumer tested trampolines in New Zealand against the Australian standard. So in effect, we have a standard in New Zealand because of the work consumer does. If anybody who's selling trampolines in New Zealand needs to beware that sooner or later consumer will test trampolines again in New Zealand, and they'll probably test them to the Australian standards. So they'd better comply with the Australian standard. But it's a little bit of a...
Sounds a bit loose.
It's a bit loose at the moment, yes.
Why don't we have our own standards?
We could do if someone put the effort into making it happen. And I could do that. But that's a conflict of interest as well. Yeah. If I do that, Springfree will say, no, we don't really want you to do that. We'd much rather be more competitive here in New Zealand. It's confused me, and I've kind of got to the point of thinking, maybe someone else can do this. If consumer are doing it by default, maybe that's enough for now.
Mm. I mean, there are a lot of accidents that occur on trampolines.
Yes.
Generally speaking, you would think that it would be in, I don't know, ACC's interest to encourage somebody to have a standard.
Yes, I agree. And in New Zealand, ACC mean that people can sell trampolines that cause injuries and there's no comeback. There's no comeback on the people selling them. ACC don't go and take them to court. The ACC help people not to sue each other.
Right, but, which is the difference between New Zealand and the United States, of course.
That's right. Huh. And that suing has the effect of making people selling trampolines very careful about what they do, whereas in New Zealand they don't have to be so careful.
Do you think that that's not good?
I think that's not good.
You're undermining the whole edifice of the ACC system in New Zealand then, aren't you?
You could say that, but there are bigger issues. There are bigger things that are undermining it as well. And when people sign a piece of paper that says it's totally my responsibility if my child goes on these trampolines in this trampoline park, that's a big risk.
If the trampolines aren't up to scratch, you mean?
Yes, or if the supervision is not up to scratch, yes.
Okay. You would have been paid quite a lot of money as a consequence of Spring Free Trampoline, I'm imagining.
Yes, that gets a bit sensitive.
I know.
I think what I'd like to say there that I've been well looked after.
And is it sensitive because you think you should have made more money out of it, or sensitive because you don't like talking about money?
It's sensitive because it's none of other people's business. But from my point of view, my objective was really to get a safer trampoline out there. And I think I would have gone about trying to make that happen, regardless of whether I got money out of it.
Are you inventing other things right now? Or working on inventions right
yes,
now?
Yes.
What are you
yes.
doing?
We're currently working on a patient transfer device that's sort of will tilt you forwards off a chair or out of a wheelchair, and then you can be wheeled to, say, the toilet or the dining room chair and be tilted back onto it again.
Who's we?
We, that's a small company. It's a small company called Hapai, which is the Maori word for carry or bear. And it's being supported by Powerhouse, which is an investor group, a Christchurch investor group, who have a close relationship with the university. So it's part of the commercialisation process from university to have Powerhouse as a group of investors that is working with the university to commercialise university products.
And is this a mechanically driven, engine driven, electronically driven thing, or is it purely a physical thing?
Yes, it's purely human driven. So there's no batteries and there's no hydraulics. It's just using mechanical advantage.
Okay.
So the concept of it is that if your centre of mass was at the centre of a wheel, and you could then roll yourself around the axle, and because you're not lifting the person at all, you're not lifting their centre of mass at all, you're not doing any work, so it's relatively easy to do. And so that was the principle behind it. Let's make a machine that rolls someone around their centre of mass so that you don't have to put in much effort as the carer who's doing the lifting. You don't have to put much effort in, but you can just tilt them forward and then wheel them around and tilt them back again. So that was the concept behind it, is let's have something that uses mechanical advantage to be able to shift people around so there's no batteries and no hydraulics, and you could have someone like your granddaughter lift their grandfather and move him around.
Or even your frail grandmother lifting your grandfather.
That's right. And then potentially that allows their marriage to continue. They can stay at home. They can stay at home longer. That was the sort of thought I had in mind. It's, of course, because we are now interfacing regularly with the real-world customers, we find that there's an opening for it in rest homes where it's actually providing another option for people to be moved around in rest homes by the carers there. And that's where the early sales are starting at the moment.
Oh, so it's actually on the market?
Yes, it's actually on the market, only just.
Okay.
Yes.
What else are you working on?
Not a lot. That is taking quite a lot of effort. So I'm
sure.
still working with.
No,
spring
I didn't mean to diminish the effort involved in that. It sounds like, it sounds like it's a really complicated process to work out that kind of balancing act, making it risk free.
Yes, it is. You've got so many things that you have to address, particularly with medical type products. And this is something that's in the, although it's low risk, it's in the medical field. And it has to meet standards of all sorts.
And would this be available elsewhere overseas? You're going to market it overseas eventually, presumably?
Yes. Yes, definitely. There's a plan to start moving to Australia at, early next year and grow the market. What we're doing is just growing sort of organically at the moment, doing small steps, finding out what the issues are, making small modifications and working up like that. And essentially it's really just around Christchurch and Canterbury at the moment. Where we're
what have you got it priced at?
We've got it priced at a price that the market says it should be, which with a medical type device is more, way more than for a trampoline type device. So the price currently is $4,000. I'm very uncomfortable with that. It seems to be way too high, but it's what the market expects. And when most of these medical type devices are not paid for by the people themselves, it's paid for by hospital boards or whatever.
Are you saying that it costs a lot less than that to make?
Yes, it costs less than that to make.
So why not charge it at a lower price? What do you mean the market expects that?
That's a really good point, but the investors are not putting their money in it for us to give it all away.
So there's a tension between you and the people who are providing the money. And they want to make more money than you do.
Yes, if you look at it from another point of view, the investors are in this whole game to make money. That they're not just doing it out of the goodness of their heart. If you want investors, then you better give them an opportunity to make money. And given that there is an opportunity here that the market will pay this, that means the investors are interested. That means we can grow the company because they'll put more money in because they want a good return on their investment. And that will grow the company faster and that will mean that more people get this lifter.
I mean, I appreciate your frankness, but what you've just said is that people are being ripped off. They shouldn't be paying that amount of money for this very useful device.
Well, yes, and we certainly had, as the next technical development, is the domestic one that would be much more in the realm of what a walker costs.
And how different would the domestic one be from the one that's going to be used in rest homes and hospitals?
Well, it would look different. It would look more like a walker than a medical device, but the function essentially would be the same.
Mm. It sounds like inventing things is, in a way, the easy bit. And the whole marketing and production is the hard stuff that you find yourselves a little unnerved by.
Well, yes.
Still.
The inventing part of it I can keep all to myself. I'm in total control of that. As soon as you start getting it out to market, then you have to have relationships with all these people, especially the customers. Unfortunately, you have to do what the customers want or you're not going to sell anything. And that puts all sorts of pressures on. And then the investors. This is what I mean about the marriage of all those people.
Yeah.
You have to keep the investors happy. You have to keep the customers happy. You have to have a business, and that has to comply with all sorts of laws and so on. And then you have to have the technology. That all has to work. So you have these four groups of people with different goals and objectives that you have to meet all their objectives. If you can make it a win-win, that's four lots of wins, then you're doing well and you've probably got a product that's going to go somewhere. But if one of them's unhappy, if the investor's unhappy, you don't get the money and you can't do anything. If the company's unhappy, it's illegal and you've got some problems. If you can't get the technology to work, you haven't got a product. And if the customers don't want it, you can invent for as long as you like and it doesn't really go anywhere.
No. Is there anything that you invented in the past that if somebody like Steve Holmes or an investor had been there at the time, you could have taken over the world with it?
I can't think of things at the moment. I have invented a lot of pointless inventions. My whole PhD was a pointless exercise.
What was it?
Yes.
What was it?
I spent 5 years developing a car with paddle wheels on it instead of wheels, and these paddle wheels were powered by a good, powerful engine. So you can imagine if you had the old paddle steamer.
This is an amphibious vehicle again.
It's an amphibious vehicle. Yes, right. That's right. It's got four wheels on it that are powered with enough power that they beat the water so hard that they lift it right up onto the top of the water and it'll run across the top of the water. And I worked right through the whole process from the concept to figuring out how it all worked, doing testing tank tests and trying to figure out how to make the blades the right shape. Built a model, made a remote control model and drove it around on the Victoria Lake in Hagley Park. And we went there 24 times, I think, during my PhD to get it to work. So that's a vehicle that I would not advise anyone to use. I'd recommend that they use a jet ski instead. There's nothing to tangle with if you fall in the water with a jet ski, but with a car with bladed wheels.
Oh, okay. Could have been disastrous, do you think?
Yes, you'd be in the water with four egg beaters.
No, but would the bladed wheel, were they made of rubber?
Well, the ones I had were made of metal.
Oh, okay.
So you could get chopped into little pieces very quickly.
Why didn't you make them of rubber?
Well, I made them with metal first because I was just trying to change the shape. When I got to the rubber part, that was the end. I knew how to do it. I wrote my thesis. I said, here's how you make them out of rubber, but no one's done that. And I still think, even if they were made out of rubber, that a jet ski is a better thing to use.
All right.
So here's something that I developed in that process was some walk-on-water shoes.
The process of that?
Yes, because I used to have to go and rescue it. Walk out there and rescue it.
And the walk on water shoes actually funded that PhD because you won a couple of radio competitions.
Yes, Radio Avon, that's right, Radio Avon competitions back in 1978, 1980, something like that. $1,000 for walking on water. I don't think they thought it could be done, but about 30 people turned up with shoes that could walk on water, so... But I won it 2 years, 2 years in a row.
Which funded your totally useless PhD.
Yeah, that's right. So walk on water shoes is something that I've invented that I'm not going to take over the world with, because walking on water is quite difficult, and if there's any wind blowing, you go in the direction of the wind. It's very slow. It's just got a charisma about it, that's all.
What would Jesus do?
I don't think he used the shoes. I think he just walked on the water instead.
The paddleboard's probably the closest.
That's the closest.
Don't you think?
Looks a bit like that, yes.
Why your fixation with watery things?
As a kid, I liked boats. I think it was and model aeroplanes. And they're both fluids, and the fluid behaves very much the same with the two of them.
And did you invent a flying thing also?
A number of flying things, yes. A magnetic flying machine. I had a go at a magnetic flying machine. I wanted to fly on the Earth's magnetic field. But that didn't work. That one didn't work.
Why not?
If you have the electricity going through a wire in a magnetic field, then the wire will be pulled in a particular direction. If you have the electricity going in the other direction, in other words, completing the circuit, then it pulls in the other direction, so it cancels out the force. I thought, you can shield magnetic things. You have them on television. The old television tubes had magnetic shielding on them. Why not put a magnetic shield on the return part of the circuit? Then you'd have the only force in one direction. The trouble is that just doesn't work because the shield only works with alternating current, and I was using direct current. But I had a lot of fun trying to make it work.
Is there anything that you wish somebody would invent? You're not in a position to invent yourself, but you wish somebody would invent.
I'm certainly not in a position to do a lot of the health stuff. I wish somebody would invent a way of, well, that I could just lick it and it would tell me, yes, you're getting a cold. Now I know why I've got a sore throat. Or you're getting
a flu.
Yeah,
but what are you going to do about that?
Well, I'd just really like to know.
No, but that's useless information because you can't cure the cold.
Well,
what are you going to do? You're just going to have a couple of days of whinging about having a cold more.
I just want to, if it's a cold, it's okay. If it's something more sinister, then it's not okay.
Right, so you want an easy, quick diagnosis as to whether you suffer from flu.
Yes.
So that you can go home and stay there.
Now I know. Yeah, it's flu. It's not a cold. It's flu. That's different. I need to go home. I need to get away from other people. Otherwise, I'm giving them the flu.
And I
can expect to be off work for 10 days or whatever. If it's a cold, I can probably keep going.
I see. All right. Well, we'll just put it out there and maybe somebody will come up with it.
That's a good idea, yes.
Yeah.
These are things that need to be invented.
Anything else?
There will be other things. That was one that could come to mind.
I would like somebody to invent, you know, the car horn, right?
Yes.
And it's only got one tone. And it's usually one of irritation. But often you need an apologetic car horn. Like, I'm sorry I tooted you in irritation before I realised that there was an elderly person crossing the road and you couldn't go. I didn't see the elderly person and I'm sorry I hooted. You need an apologetic car horn. Or you need a, yeah, I got that joke car horn. Or you need a, you should never drive again car horn, which is one up from irritation. Do you know what I mean? We need a range of tones for the car horn.
I'm smiling. I think that's a really good idea.
Could you work on that?
What a lovely thing to do, yes. Driving and road rage would just disappear and driving would become a pleasure. In fact, quite amusing sometimes.
Possibly noisy, but, you know.
Yes, there's places where car horns are very noisy and it could be wonderful. It could be wonderful.
I'm just putting it out there. I'm putting it out there for you, Professor Alexander.
We're not good at expressing ourselves in New Zealand, mate. We need horns just like that.
See? Professor Alexander and I are of a mind.